Welcome to our weekly Church on the Rock podcast. For more information, visit us at churchak.org, download our Church on the Rock AK app, or like us on our Facebook page. Thank you for listening, and we hope you enjoy our weekly podcast.
We're in a series called Filters, and here's the question, the big question that we've been asking in this series: what are the events and influences in our lives that have significantly shaped the way we see the world? What are the influencers in our lives that have significantly shaped the way that we view our world? And here's what we believe. We believe that when Jesus comes on the scene, that he isn't just coming to bring a new philosophy or a new ideology, a whole new set of values, but what he's really doing is he's coming to bring a whole new reality. That he wants us to see life for what it really is. He wants to ground us and root that in that whole new reality so that we can move through life the way we were meant to move. He says, I came to bring life and to give it to you in abundance. And part of that is that we can actually see the way God wants things to actually be. And so here's the problem is if we're not careful, some of the philosophies and some of the thinking of the day can actually come in and mask that reality and cause confusion. And so what we've been doing is we've been walking through a number of the different masks or a number of the different filters that can come in and kind of take us away from God's perspective, from God's mind, or that reality. And today is no exception. I want to take us to a subject or a category, and that's the category of the company we keep. And to be specific, I really want to talk about bad company because it's way more interesting, right? So we're going to talk about bad company because here's something we all know. We all know, whether you're a Christian or not, we all know that we can get into that crowd or we can get into that company that has a corrosive influence in our life. In other words, people that are surrounding us, that are feeding us information, feeding us their thoughts or philosophies, but they deviate from the truth or they take us down a road that we never intended to go. And the reason it's so dangerous to be in bad company is because it takes a philosophy or it takes a teaching or an ideology and it anchors it into a real relationship. And let me illustrate what I mean by that. The Old Testament put it into an example by using one of the kings of Israel. Supposedly the wisest man on earth at the time, Solomon. And Solomon's one of the kings of Israel. Well, there were some very specific instructions that God had for the kings of Israel. And one of those instructions is that there are certain things that a king of Israel was not to accumulate. And this was different than the kings of the other lands, but this was specific to Israel. There were certain things that the king of Israel was not to accumulate. One of those things was a whole bunch of wives. And Solomon decided that he was going to go ahead and kind of shirk that responsibility and go his own way. And so he is known in the Hebrew Old Testament as somebody who accumulated all kinds of wives and all kinds of concubines to boot. And what happened in that story, the moral of that story, is that those wives ended up leaving Solomon bankrupt. He actually left the Lord in some sense, and he allowed them to influence him and his kingdom to the point where they were able to build their pagan high places all over the land of Israel. And not only did Solomon get led astray, but so did the children of Israel. And here's what happened. Because those philosophies and that thinking was anchored into real relationship, those wives made good look evil and evil look good. And all of a sudden, things that were so clear were no longer as clear, and Solomon ended up being the recipient of a whole bunch of bad company. Now, if that's your problem, you have tons of wives and they're leading you the wrong direction, there's probably a TV show about you. But we may not relate to that, but here's the deal. We probably relate to the idea of bad company or the corrosive influence in our life, right? For instance, some of us maybe came out of addiction. And as a part of that addiction, we realized that there was a group of people that had invited us into that way of thinking or that lifestyle or those choices that we made. And then we'd made the decision that we were going to go a different direction. We're going to head a different direction. And we did, and we got out of all that. And for some of us, it was actually a geography that we had to leave, a space that we had to leave. But then some of those friends, circled back around or found us online, and they begin to pull us back in. And all of a sudden, the things that we thought we had beat begin to emerge once again as passions in our life, because it was anchored into a relationship, and those relationships had power over us to kind of draw us back in. For some of us, it was in our teenage years. You remember those days where there was that really cute guy or that really cute girl, and that was kind of the open door, and you needed to be loved, and you wanted to be liked, and all of a sudden that relationship turned into more than you thought it should be or could be, but because there was a relationship there, you headed that direction anyway, and all of a sudden you were asked to compromise in areas you didn't want to compromise in, and you were caught in a quandary because of bad company. Or maybe more real for most of us at this stage in our life, if you're where I'm at, is you're involved in business somewhere, and in order to get that next promotion, you know what you have to do. You know that there's a way to get to that next level, and everybody else in your office space is doing that, but because of your integrity, you won't do that. But now times are tough, and you're not so sure that isn't the better way to go, and you don't want to compromise, but you know compromise is the only way to go to get where you want to go, and bad company can have a corrosive influence in our lives, which causes us to sort of ask this question, what do we do when the people we're closest to lead us in the wrong direction or steer us down the wrong path? And is it inevitable that because we're just simply in the proximity of bad company that we'll automatically end up going in the wrong direction? And for those of us who are Christians, right, who really want to carry out the mission of God, who want to do what is right, how do we do that? How do we maintain the course in a world with competing ideas, where there's so much darkness and so much confusion? Well, those are real questions. And if you grew up in some form of religion, and maybe this wasn't the church that we're thinking of, but just some religion or some religious experience, here's the reality is you probably had a very clear answer to these questions. And the answer looked something like this. It looked like separation. That separation is where we tend to move when it comes to staying the course or maintaining the direction that we initially intended. And this looks a lot of different ways in different religions. I mean, it can even be separation down to little nitty-gritty details like what clothes you wear, what foods you eat. But the bottom line is that oftentimes the way we think is that what we need to do is we need to figure out who are the good guys and who are the bad guys. And the only way to do that is to put walls, barriers, borders, and boundary markers in place. Do you know what I'm saying? In fact, if you were raised in the church and you're a Christian, we even had a verse that kind of told us how to separate or told us that this was an important thing. And the verse is out of 1 Corinthians, Paul's speaking, and he actually says this. It says, "Do not be deceived. Bad company corrupts good morals." And the underlying assumption here is that if we hang out with the wrong people, what will it do to us? Well, if we hang out with the wrong people, they're going to corrupt us. So what's the only logical thing to do? Not hang out with the wrong people. And so that's what we've done, right? And we build these walls, and we build these borders and these places of separation. And sometimes we even build walls with other churches, right? Because, I mean, it could be anything. It could be the liturgy. It could be the way we read our Bibles or the version that we use or the songs that we sing. It could be anything that actually forms as boundary markers that determines who's on the inside and who is on the outside. But separation is key. The basic assumption behind this idea of separation is that the outside automatically shapes the inside. For the Jews growing up under the Old Testament law, they used terms like this, clean and unclean. We don't talk that way anymore in our culture, but we maybe think the same way, that there are unclean things and there are clean things, and God forbid that we should ever touch something that is unclean, because if there's something that's unclean that we touch, it will inevitably mark us or it will stain us. And so we put up rules and rituals and obligations in place to make sure that we never cross that line. What I want to do this morning is I want to take us to a passage in the Old Testament, the Hebrew Bible, the Hebrew Scriptures, that actually speaks to this issue. So, and it pushes back. Like, so how do we maintain our integrity in the middle of bad company? Is it even possible? And there's a passage in the Old Testament that, again, I want to take us to that addresses this specific question. But to kind of set the table for this passage, you have to understand something about it first. And that is that when this passage was written, it was written to a group of people, the Jews, but it was written to a group of people that were returning to the land of Israel. So if you remember Jewish history, God saves a people out of Egypt, brings them through the waters, and they go into a land, and they conquer a land for the most part, right? And then they didn't obey God, and so God removes them or kicks them out of the land. And while they're outside of the land, they're among the nations, and predominantly between the Persians, the Medo-Persians, right, the Babylonians, the Assyrians. They're scattered throughout the world. Well, after about 70 years, they are able, by Cyrus's decree, to return to their homeland, to return to the land of Israel. And this is the days of Ezra and Nehemiah. Now, here's what's so interesting. When the Jews initially made it from Canaan, right, the land of Egypt to the land of Canaan, it was really clear what their objective was. Their objective was to go in, to rout everybody out, and to set up a holy people and a holy nation. And they would put boundaries in place, and there was ways to maintain separation. But here's what's so unique about Ezra and Nehemiah's day. They couldn't escape the corrosion and the influence of the nations around them. Because while they were outside of the land, other people had come into the land and placed themselves with homes and fields and heritages, and new languages had emerged. And while they were outside of the land, these other people came in and they set up their temples and they set up their gods and they set up their thinking. And when the Jews return, they don't have the ability to kick them out of the land. As a matter of fact, they now have to live in the land, but they still have to stay on mission. And this is what I love about it. How do you live in the middle of all of that corrosive bad company and at the same time maintain your integrity? Well, this was the task for Israel. But they didn't have the normal tools that they used to have. So they used to have king, they had a military, they had finances. They had the ability to kind of maintain their culture. They had a temple. They had their Bible, right? They had all of those things that sort of highlighted who God was and what God's will and God's plan for their lives was. But by the time they get back to the land, they're biblically illiterate. In fact, they had actually learned the languages of the Babylonians. And at this period of time, if you look back at even how they wrote, they no longer wrote in the ancient Hebrew script, but they had the Babylonian letters. They actually changed the alphabet on them. And so they come back, and there's actually a story where you see the scribes actually reading the law, reading the Old Testament to the Jews, and the people weep because they didn't even know. It had to be explained to them in their own language because they had changed languages. They were as fractured as a people. Their culture was disintegrating. And you can imagine in this context how a parent might feel trying to raise their children to be pure and holy and undefiled in a completely lawless and pagan society with so many competing worldviews and filters. Well, it's at this moment that God chooses to embed a song. We know it as a psalm. And we know it as Psalm 1. And in Psalm 1, it has first place among the Psalms. We don't know who wrote Psalm 1, but here's what we do know. We know this, that after about 1,000 years of history, a number of psalms or songs had been written. And at this particular time in Israel's history, somebody, again, we don't know who, somebody sat down to actually compile the list that you and I have today in our Bibles. And they chose not to put the first psalm written as first, but they chose to put one of the last psalms ever written as first. In other words, its order was significant. It's as if to say, this psalm is the psalm above all other psalms. Like if you get Psalm 1, you'll understand the pattern and the flow for the rest of the psalms. And God anchors this psalm in the Jewish culture for this reason. Not only did the Jews not have the tools that they used to have to be able to maintain their culture and discover the will of God and move forward as a society, but here's the thing that was happening. And it's something that I think we will face if we're not already facing it, or you may have already faced this, but it looked or it appeared from all accounts that the way that the wicked, and it calls them white, the righteous and the wicked in the Old Testament, but the way the wicked, those who didn't believe in God and who weren't heading towards God, the way they were living looked better than the way the Jews were living. They were envied by the nations. And you're raising your family and you're raising your children, and your children are looking outside the window at the world around them. They're like, Mom, Dad, it's way better what they're doing. They're getting ahead faster. They're going farther. They're more beautiful. Their philosophy seems to be working. It doesn't seem to be working what you guys are doing. And it's in this moment that Psalm 1 begins to emerge as the psalm among all other psalms. And it begins with hope. Listen to the words of the psalmist as he begins, how blessed is the man. You just insert yourself into that picture, but how blessed is the man. And this idea of blessing, actually, there's two words for blessed. There's the one that we're more familiar with, like, oh, how happy. Like, I'm really, really happy, or I'm really, really feeling blessed right now, right? Because of something I've encountered, some truth that I've encountered, or something that's happening in my life. But this is another word, and this is the word that we use when somebody actually looks at our lives and the things that are happening in our lives, and they call us blessed. You could actually translate this, oh, how enviable. In other words, this is so pregnant with meaning to the Jews at this point. They're looking outside and they're saying, the wicked are enviable. And the writer of the psalm says, listen, here's a way for you to be enviable. So how do you do that? What do you do to be the blessed in God's eyes? Well, he first starts out with what we shouldn't do. He says, blessed is the man who does not walk in the counsel of the wicked, nor stand in the path of sinners, nor sit in the seat of scoffers. There's a natural progression here. There's the idea of first walking, then standing, then sitting. Seems like when we encounter philosophies, it often goes that way, right? I mean, it starts out with a conversation, it ends up in a friendship, but the next thing we know, we're buying into stuff we never imagined we would ever buy into. But the idea here is that there's a philosophy that's against God, and therefore it's not going to be blessed by him. And this philosophy or this thinking, this way of thinking, this pattern, is something that starts out as a casual influence, a casual counsel. Hey, have you heard this? Hey, do you know anything about this? No, my parents never told me that, right? And then it moves from there to sort of, wait, hold on, I need to ask more questions, where there's this pause. You're no longer walking together, right? You're like, well, hold on a second, tell me more. And then it moves from there to, hey, we need to get coffee. I need to know everything you know. And there's this progression towards this philosophy, and the philosophy is really centered on the idea of anything that scoffs against what is right, or anything that scoffs against the knowledge of God. It moves from this idea of just taking counsel to actually endorsing the philosophy that what God calls right is actually wrong, and there is another way to live right. And the psalmist says, listen, I want you to know there is a way to be blessed by the wicked, but it's not by buying into their reality. It's not by viewing life through their filters, their lens. There is a way to be blessed and to be enviable by the nations, but it isn't by buying into the way that they think. Well, how do you get blessed? Well, here's what he has to say. He says, his delight is in the law of the Lord, or the instruction of the Lord. I think the best illustration for delight is when you come home and, you know, if you ever had a little girl, I mean, little guys are great, but little girls, I'm telling you, right? And you come home, and that little girl comes up to you, and you walk through the door, and they just leap into your arms. That's delight. And you're just the object of their overflowing affection, right? That's just delight. That's delight. His delight, if you want to be blessed, here's how you do it. His delight is in the instruction or the counsel of the Lord. Don't follow the counsel of those who don't know what righteousness looks like. Don't follow their lens. Don't listen to them, but instead listen to God. Listen to his instruction and meditate on his law. And do it day and night. Now, the reason day and night is mentioned here is strategic. We're going to find out a little bit why it's so strategic in just a minute, but just for the moment, kind of put that in the back of your mind. But there is this regular digestion. Erwin Gray, a speaker at youth events, likes to call meditation marination. This idea that what we're really called to do here is to take the word or to take the instruction of God and just kind of let it flow over us and then sink deeply within us, right? Just marinate ourselves in it. And really the idea is to allow it to influence our thinking. It's to counsel us. It's to be our wise counselor. And the reason this is important is because it anchors us into reality. Like, there's a real way that we should live. There's a righteous way, a way that is blessable by God, and we need to be anchored in that if we're going to receive that blessing, and the Word of God makes that take place. We need to meditate on it, or mumble it is literally the word for meditate. We need to get it inside of us. Get in a life group. Get in a Bible study, right? Get in a place where you can put yourself under somebody's teaching and learn what the Word of God says. That's what this is suggesting that the nation of Israel needs to do. His delight is in the law of the Lord. In his law, he meditates day and night. Well, what is the result of this meditation? Well, here's the result, and this is really the point of the whole psalm. He or she will be like a tree. You ever wanted to be like a tree? This is your chance. He will be like a tree firmly planted. Now, notice that you don't plant yourself here. But it's through the process of meditation that you become planted, that God does the planting. And this planting is done in a Jewish mind, right, in a dry and arid land, like in a place where there's danger, in a place of cultural contextual philosophies that are competing for your allegiance. He will be like a tree firmly planted or rooted by streams of water, which yield its fruit in season. His leaf does not wither, and whatever he does, he prospers. Now, who doesn't want that? And the idea here is, right, is that there's this prospering that can take place. Now, remember the context. They're in a place where they can't escape the influence of the wicked. And yet, in this place, there is a way to prosper. There is a way out of being hemmed in by the philosophies that were winning the day. There was a way forward, not just for them, but for their children, for their nation. There was a way to live. There was a way to think that would lead to their ability to be fruitful as people in this life. Well, this is contrasted with those who do not buy in to the reality of God. The wicked, and again, they're just known as the wicked here. We don't use that term, but that's the term the psalmist uses. The wicked are those who are opposed to God. They are not so. They aren't firmly rooted. But look at what happens to their lives. They come to ruin. They're like chaff, which the wind drives away. Now, if you can just imagine for a moment, the idea of being planted by streams and being fruitful and being prosperous means that in any environment, I have the ability to be prosperous. No matter what storms come, no matter how hard the wind blows, I have the ability to be prosperous if my meditation is on the Word of God day and night. Like, storms come day and night, right? You don't get to pick when the storm comes. It's a day and night experience. It's an adversity that's just there. It's in nature. It's part of the environment. But here's the great news. If you have rooted yourself in the Word of God, you can withstand that. Not so the wicked. In fact, it's in this moment that when the storms come, that they're like chaff. But the word storm is not even used here. It's the word light, gentle breeze. It's just a small wind. And he's drawing our attention to something that everybody in the Middle East understands who lives next to the Mediterranean Sea. Every evening in the Mediterranean Sea, there's a light breeze that comes up, and that's the time to go out to the threshing floor, get your pitchfork, and start throwing the grains into the air. And as you throw the grain into the air, the good stuff that you want to eat drops to the bottom, and the worthless stuff called chaff is driven away by even the slightest whisper. You guys catch it? It says, the wicked are not so. They're not rooted. They're not able to withstand, but they actually come to ruin. They're like chaff, which the wind drives away. Therefore, the wicked will not stand in the judgment. The judgment here is day and night. We think of judgment automatically as like heaven and hell, but that theology wasn't quite there yet in their thinking. They're just simply thinking of this day and night adversity, this experience of living with their families in the land where there is adversity and competing ideas all around. He says, listen, if you want to be blessed, if you want to stand, here's the way to stand. But it's in this moment of testing, when the wind begins to blow, that we know who God stands with and we know who God doesn't stand with. So he finishes his thought with a summation statement, Psalm 1, verse 6. He says, for the Lord knows, or the Lord is intimately acquainted with the way of the righteous, but the way of the wicked will come to ruin. It'll perish. The idea, again, is this, that when testing comes, it's at this moment that those who are righteous and righteous actions emerge as beneficial, emerge as what's truly reality. It's in this moment when the testing comes that we begin to realize for the first time what right and wrong and the consequences of right and wrong, what they actually produce. And the psalmist is simply calling their attention and by extension calling our attention to the fact that you may be living a life that's righteous and nobody knows it, but it will emerge. People will look at you someday when they have seen your life and seen you pass through the tests of life, and when the wind blows, if your roots have gone deep, if God has planted you, in that moment, they will say, you know what? I don't know if I want to be that. I don't know if I want to believe that, but that person is blessed. That person is enviable. I wish I had what they have. The psalmist is saying there's a way to live in this life, in this context, and receive that kind of blessing. Not just the blessing of God, but even the blessing of your enemy. Don't go backwards. Press on. Keep moving forwards. Don't let them pull you backwards. Don't buy into their philosophies. Stay the course. Now, here's the big idea. Israel could not escape their enemies. They could not escape the philosophies. They could not escape the corrosive influences, like maybe you and I can escape those corrosive influences. They couldn't do it. They could no longer maintain separation. They had to live and form their new ideology, their new philosophy in that land. It was foreign to the people, but they had to bring the word of God to bear on their country, on their land, to be blessed by God. But if they did it, if they stayed the course, they could thrive in the middle of that darkness and that confusion. And I got to confess that this is meaningful to me, and I'll tell you why. I got 4 kids that I'm trying to raise. Anybody else out there? And I got to believe that there's a way for them to live righteously even when they're in the context of darkness and confusion. I got to believe that there's a way for them to move forward in life. And not just for them, but even for me, right? I mean, is it possible for me to actually know what is right and to do what is right? Or am I just beholden to the environment? When I was canoeing and backpacking in some of the places around here, the wilderness on the Kenai, I was instructed, we were on a lake, and the lake, every year the lake freezes over, and then it thaws, and then it freezes, and then it thaws. I mentioned it's going to be a cold winter, and then it freezes again, and then it thaws. And what it does, it forms these ice-carved ramparts, ice-shaved ramparts. There are these berms that exist on the edge of the lake. You've probably seen them if you've been out there canoeing a little bit. And it's like this environmental factor shapes, it inevitably and kind of automatically shapes the land. I got to believe there's a different way to live, that there's a way out of that pattern, that the environment alone is not the only thing that shapes me, that something else can allow me to have a rudder and head towards righteousness and get where I need to go. I want to be like Noah, who was able to live in a wicked and perverse generation and still be righteous and incidentally be called blessed, because when the storm came, and the rain came, everybody knew God stood with Noah. Are you with me? Here's what's so amazing about this passage to me. It's not just that there's the possibility of living a righteous life. You probably knew that. But I think something else is actually being taught here. There's the strong suggestion that life actually reveals who is righteous. In other words, it actually, as we engage with life, it actually shows those who are living rightly. Do you know what I mean? It shows those who are living rightly for who they really are. That person is righteous. You may be living righteously and nobody knows it, but when a storm comes and you stay the course, everybody knows it. That person has firm footing. They're rooted. They're able to reach out at the same time that they're around all kinds of philosophies and confusion and darkness, and it doesn't seem to take them off course. God is with them. Do you know anybody like that? In Israel, they had a whole list of stories. Patriarchs, people who they could list off, who had stayed the course, who had done what was right, even when it was difficult, even when everybody else said that they were wrong. And because they did what was right, they were able to conquer kingdoms, right? They were able to invade. They were able to worship God. They were able to do all kinds of things and influence society for the good. There is a way to live that actually reveals who is right. Which is why I believe that God does not call you and me to escapism. He's not actually calling us to escape life. He actually wants to root us in the battle. He wants to place us on the battlefield of life. In fact, when Jesus comes on the scene and he has the opportunity to pray for his disciples, get in on this verse. I think it's amazing and profound. John chapter 17, verse 15 says this. Here's my prayer. You want to know how Jesus prays for you? And I think he prays this way for you today. My prayer is not that you take them out of the world. I don't want you to let them escape. I want you to protect them. I have to confess, this is exactly what I pray for my children. I mean, it can be terrifying, right? I wonder what decisions that they will make. I wonder what decisions I will make when the pressure is really on. But Jesus says, I'm not afraid of you being in the middle of the battle. I'm not calling you to a place of getting away and building walls and building barriers and separating yourself from society. I'm actually calling you to be in the middle of it. But don't worry, in the middle of it, when you do what is right, I will act as a strong tower that you can run into in the middle of the fight, and I will be right there with you in the middle of the battle. Later on, this same apostle who recorded these words of Jesus writes to a group of believers who's being fed to the lions in Nero's Colosseum, and they're wondering, what are we supposed to do? Are we just supposed to, is this the extent of it? Is Jesus coming back? Is this worth it? What do we do? And John, the Apostle John, gives them some incredible advice, and he doesn't say to escape, run for the hills. Listen to what he has to say. He says this is a familiar verse, greater is he who is in you. I remember encountering this for the first time. I don't know who said it, if it was my dad or if it happened in Sunday school or if it was at camp, but I just remember the first time I heard this, that greater is he who is in me, because I was being raised in the public realm. And let me tell you, I was the only Christian in my classroom in California. And I remember how encouraging it was to hear the words, greater is he who is in you than he who is in the world. Greater is he who is in you. This was the word that John preached to the early church when they were up against a wall and they didn't know where to turn. So, that sounds great, but what about bad company corrupts good morals? I mean, we read that verse, right? We teach that verse to our children. Bad company corrupts good morals. I mean, there's no getting around it. It couldn't be any more clear. It's just what happens. It seems like environment can still play a major role. Well, this may be the only reason you came here today is because you've plastered that verse on your refrigerator or, you know, on the bunk bed of your kid's room. I don't know. But I want to actually shift your thinking just a little bit about where we automatically want to go with that verse. That's an interesting passage. It comes to us from the Apostle Paul as he's writing to the church in Corinth. And the Apostle Paul was up against the wall with a bunch of false teachers. And here's what they were teaching. They were teaching that the resurrection wasn't real. And what the Apostle Paul is saying is, if you lose the resurrection, if you get rid of that and you buy into the false teaching, it will actually diminish your life. It will diminish your experience. We just sang some incredible songs about resurrection. They give us so much hope to know that this is not all there is, that God is a God who has have resurrection power, that he is able to influence our life and infuse it with the kind of power, the same power that rose Jesus from the grave, and that someday we will rise from the dead too, that death is not the final word, right? But that resurrection is the final word, and that gives us incredible amount of hope as we move through this world. And these false teachers were stealing that away and diminishing their hope. And so the Apostle Paul says this, bad company corrupts. And the word there is actually bad communication. It's the Greek word homily, which we get homiletician, which is what I'm doing right now. It's preaching or communicating. Bad communication is what leads to corrupt morals. Or really, the idea is when we share the same truth, if we were to buy into this false teaching, it would actually lead us down the wrong path. The idea is not proximity to bad company, but influence. Stop listening to their influence. Maintain the course. Which leads me to this conclusion. What we think matters more than the company we keep. What we think matters more than the company we keep. How many of you know not all thoughts are equal? That there is a reality, there's a way to live rightly, there is a way to think properly, and if we can think that way, it actually has a result. In fact, this is what the Apostle Paul says as he writes to a group of Christians who could not escape their situation in Rome. He writes this to them. He says this, "And do not be conformed. Don't be squeezed into the mesh and the philosophy of the day. Do not be conformed to this world, but you have a choice in the matter. There is a way out. Let me tell you what that way out is. You can be what? Say it with me. Transformed. You can be transformed. This metamorphosis can happen on the inside. You can be transformed by what? By separation, boundary markers, rules, rituals, obligations, anything that separates and allows you to see what the good people are doing and what the bad people are doing so that you can be part of the good people. No. Do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. It begins, Paul says, with the way you think. Blessed is he, right, who delights in the instruction of God. He will be like a tree firmly planted. It's as if it's more important that we share the truth of God than we try to avoid living in proximity to those who don't share that truth. Now, let me tell you why I think this is so strategic for us as a church, and then I'm going to tell you why I think it's important for you. I think this is an important teaching for the church in this day and age because when Jesus, when Jesus comes onto the scene, he moves strategically towards places of darkness, confusion, and death. And he says, follow me. It's as if to say, if you're going to be with me, which is the place of the most amount of blessing, if you're going to be with me, you're going to need to move through the world like I move through the world. And I'm just telling you that that was a hard teaching for the disciples in that day. He went to the graveyard. The disciples were there. They didn't want to enter because that meant defilement, because they were clean and they were unclean and there were rules and there were rituals, there were obligations, and their theology wouldn't let them do it. But Jesus' theology let them do it, and he actually delivers a demoniac as a result of his good thinking and his good theology to instruct his disciples that they had the same power. He moves through the religious structures of the day, and he enters a synagogue, and in the synagogue, there's a man with a withered hand, and that withered hand needed to be healed, but the law actually prohibited miracles from happening. It was considered work, but Jesus ignores that religious structure, and he heals the man's hand. And the man understood in that moment that he would be kicked out of the synagogue and ostracized, and his people would reject him. Jesus understood it, and the disciples understood it. Jesus does it anyway, and he's taking his disciples with him. In fact, Jesus was so known for hanging out with bad company that they actually called him the friend of sinners. Listen, Jesus goes to places of death. I believe he's asking us to go there with him. And if we're going to actually consider ourselves to be his disciples, his followers, learning under his tutelage, we must go where Jesus goes. We don't have an option. I don't believe for a minute that Jesus is actually calling us to escape our environments. I believe that what he's actually doing is anchoring us in specific environments. Here's why that's important for you. I don't know what it is for you that God is calling you to do, or what environment you need to move around in, and what philosophies you need to gear up for the battle with or think through. But here's what I do know. I know this. There is only one way to maintain the course in the environment that God has strategically placed you in, and it's to hold tightly, to grasp tightly to the promises of God. In fact, as the writer to the Hebrews, we don't know who that was, but whoever wrote the book of Hebrews, as he is writing to this group of people, this group of people was wondering if it was going to be worth it. I mean, the pressure from the Jews to go back to Judaism was immense. The pressure from the Romans to forsake the way was immense. The persecution was immense. The properties were being taken away. The philosophy, the wicked seemed to be enviable. In that moment, the writer of the Hebrews has this to say to that particular audience, and I think he has this to say to this particular audience. He says, I want you to focus on the promises of God, and he contains all the promises of God in a word, the word hope. He says this, we have this hope. What hope? The hope of resurrection, the hope of having Jesus with me wherever I go, the hope of being with him for an eternity, the hope of ruling and reigning with Jesus so that we don't shrink back. We have this hope. If we are to maintain this hope, keep it in front of us, delight in it, believe the promises of God, here will be the result. If we have this hope, we have this hope as an anchor for the soul. You want to be anchored? You want to be rooted? You want those roots to go deep so that you can withstand the storms and your kids can withstand the storms, even if you don't have a way of escape from the corrosive influences of culture and the things that might be coming our way? Get them into the Word. Be an anchor for the soul. I mean, that's why we meet, right? One of the reasons. Lord, teach me. Listen to the voice of the Spirit over the voice and the cry of the media. I'm telling you, it'll change your life. Remind yourself of the good things that God has for you. Because you're making decisions, aren't you? About what to do with your kids. And we have so much freedom, and I'm so thankful for that. We may not always have the freedoms we enjoy. Is it possible to make good decisions and for all of us to live righteous lives? Yeah, it is. As some of us are wondering, should we even have children? Should we bring them into this world the way it is? I want to answer that question for you. The answer is yes. It's possible to have a godly home, godly family, to move forward. But what about all the pressures and what about all the things and work? You know, it's just going to get more complex. Yeah, it is. And persecution could come. It could. But you know what? I got news for you. You dwell on the promises of God, it'll act as an anchor for your soul. You can survive. Not only that, you can thrive. It all begins with what we think. Move toward Jesus to give you a whole new reality.
Thank you for listening. For more of our podcasts and to discover how you can connect, visit us at churchak.org. Or download our Church on the Rock AK app from either iTunes or Google Play.